reading from the Autobiography of a Yogi, from the chapter entitled Years in My Master's Hermitage. My guru ordinarily was gentle and affable to his guests. His welcome was given with charming cordiality. Yet, inveterate egotists sometimes suffered an invigorating shock. They confronted in Master either a frigid indifference or a formidable opposition, ice or iron. A noted chemist once crossed swords with Sri Yukteswar. The visitor would not admit the existence of God, inasmuch as science had devised no means of detecting him. So, you have inexplicably failed to isolate the supreme power in your test tubes. Master's gaze was stern. I recommend an unheard-of experiment. Examine your thoughts unremittingly for 24 hours, then wonder no longer at God's absence. A celebrated pundit received a similar jolt. With ostentatious zeal, the scholar shook the ashram rafters with scriptural lore. Resounding passages poured from the Mahabharata, the Upanishads, the Bhashyas of Shankara. I am waiting to hear you, Sri Yukteswar's tone was inquiring, as though utter silence had reigned. The pundit was puzzled. Quotations there have been, in superabundance. Master's words convulsed me with mirth as I squatted in my corner at a respectful distance from the visitor. But what original commentary can you supply from the uniqueness of your particular life? What holy text have you absorbed and made your own? In what ways have these timeless truths renovated your nature? Are you content to be a hollow Victrola, mechanically repeating the words of other men? I give up, the scholar's chagrin was comical. I have no inner realization. For the first time, perhaps, he understood that discerning placement of a comma does not atone for a spiritual coma. These bloodless pendants smell unduly of the lamp, my guru remarked after the departure of a chastened one. They prefer philosophy to be a gentle intellectual setting up exercise. Their elevated thoughts are carefully unrelated either to the crudity of outward action or to any scourging inner discipline. Master stressed on other occasions the futility of mere book learning. Do not confuse understanding with the larger vocabulary, he remarked. Sacred writings are beneficial in stimulating desire for inward realization. If one stanza at a time is slowly assimilated, continual intellectual study results in vanity and the false satisfaction of an undigested knowledge. Sri Yukteswar related one of his own experiences in scriptural edification. The scene was a forest hermitage in eastern Bengal, where he observed the procedure of a renowned teacher, Dabu Balav. His method, at once simple and difficult, was common in ancient India. Dabu Balav had gathered his disciples around him in the sylvan solitudes. The holy Bhagavad Gita was open before them. Steadfastly, they looked at one passage for a half an hour, then closed their eyes. Another half an hour slipped away. The master gave a brief comment. Motionless, they meditated again for an hour. Finally, the guru spoke. Have you understood? Yes, sir. One in the group ventured this assertion. No, not fully. Seek the spiritual vitality that has given these words the power to rejuvenate India century after century. Another hour disappeared in silence. The master dismissed the students and turned to Sri Yukteswar. Do you know the Bhagavad Gita? No, sir, not really. Though my eyes and mind have run through its passages many times. Thousands have replied to me differently. The great sage smiled at Master and Blessing. If one busies himself with an outer display of scriptural wealth, what time is left for silent inward diving after the priceless pearls? Sri Yukteswar directed the study of his own disciples by the same intensive method of one-pointedness. Wisdom is not assimilated with the eyes, but with the atoms, he said. When your conviction of a truth is not merely in your brain, but in your being, you may diffidently vouch for its meaning. He discouraged any tendency a student might have to construe book knowledge as a necessary step to spiritual realization. The Rishis wrote in one sentence profundities that commenting scholars busy themselves over for generations. He remarked, endless literary controversy is for the sluggard minds. What more liberating thought than God is, nay, God? But man does not easily return to simplicity. It is seldom God for him, but rather learned pomposities. His ego is pleased that he can grasp such erudition. On the path of wisdom. In the yoga tradition, there are four main avenues of approach to the divine truth and realization. One of those avenues is through karma yoga. Karma is the path of action. When you act in total subservient service to the divine, within the action or to the person that you're doing the action for. And through that inner surrender, you come to the realization that the divine resides within all beings. The second tradition comes in bhakti yoga. In bhakti yoga, love and devotion for a chosen ishta, aspect of the divine, captures the heart and mind and focuses the whole soul upon the divine goal through that manifestation of God with a form or God with light or one of his attributes. There is then the path of Raja Yoga. In Raja Yoga, we aspire for the divine by learning to meditate with a single fixed point of concentration, to revolve the life force within the body system so that the breath, the mind, and the life energy may all be brought into a single point of concentration and thereby transcending into the supreme truth and light. The fourth then is Jnana Yoga, or Jnani Yoga. And that is the path of wisdom. It is the use of the mind and wisdom in order to direct the self from ignorance to enlightenment. The difficulty comes for the Jnana Yoga, for the one with wisdom, is that the mind itself is not capable of knowing the supreme truth. The mind's very tendency is to make constructs, to label those constructs, and then to develop a relationship between the self and those constructs. When the subject is God or truth or eternal wisdom, the mind tries to construct a certain image of what God is, of what truth is, of what that light is. It then gives a mental label to what that construct is and develops a relationship to it. Of course, when you're talking about something that is eternal, infinite, of unlimited nature, The mind simply cannot construct a mental image, a thought, a relationship that is expansive enough to encompass the totality of what God is. So in the wisdom of the great yonis, it is said that it is like the man who is walking down the path. As he is walking down the path, he gets this thorn into his foot, and it causes him a lot of pain. So, of course, he wants to remove the thorn. He looks around, but he finds he has no tools to remove the thorn, and it's very deeply embedded within the foot. So it's not easily gotten out. He looks around at what nature has provided him, and he sees that there's another thorn. He takes that other thorn, and he begins to pry underneath the skin, looking for the original thorn that's causing the problem. Gradually, he sees its head, and he begins to pry out the thorn that's giving him a problem, using the thorn that he found upon the ground. In this way, a thorn is used to remove a thorn. This is an apt analogy for what the mind is used for. The mind itself is the problem. It is the thorn within the side of mankind. It causes us to be vacillating in our thoughts. It creates desire. Its focus upon the body and upon the senses creates an outward direction for the mind that takes it further into ignorance. That is, further from the realization of the true supreme self that resides within. And so the thorn of the mind is used to remove the thorn of ignorance. I remember the opening shots of a television show called MASH, and in it the participants were standing on a hill and they were looking out in the direction of the camera. Meanwhile, you see behind them the helicopter approaching them. Now, they're not seeing, not hearing, for some reason, the helicopter. They're looking off in the opposite direction. And finally, when the helicopter is almost on top of them, they hear it, they feel it, and they turn around, and they see what they've been looking for. For the spiritual aspirant, it is a similar kind of situation. We look out into the world for truth, for happiness, for light, to be informed of who and what we truly are. But it is not until we turn within that we see that the light was always dwelling right behind us. St. John the Divine, in his Revelation, says that he was lifted up and he's turned around. And there he saw the seven churches, the seven candles. This is an internal experience that happens. When you are lifted up into divine consciousness in this way, the third eye can see from any perspective. It can see from within the body. It can see from outside of the body. It can see from above the body. It can have an expansive consciousness that sees with a thousand different eyes, so to speak. In other words, its vision ranges wherever it puts its attention. And so it is in this supreme consciousness that the vision is clarified. And the perspective may be taken from any direction. I remember a time when I was taken inwardly, and I was shown a vision that came from the brainstem. And at the brainstem, I was looking upward into the cavity of the skull. And there was this beautiful Christ blue light that was shining in an apparent sphere above me. And yet the sphere had no definite boundaries to it. It seemed to extend forever. And yet it had this definite feeling of a sphere. Perhaps much as the sky does, we look up above us and it appears to have a convex type of shape to it, a contour. And yet we know that there is, in reality, no shape to it. It just simply extends out and is a reflection of light, and gradually expands itself into all space. In like manner, this internal vision showed me this beautiful Christ light existing right within my own cranial cavity. And yet it was not confined to the cranium itself, but extended out into fathomless dimensions. That as the mind expanded, it could be perceived, but it could not be contained. And this is perhaps the great truth with realization. God can be perceived. God can be known. But God cannot be contained. You may be an instrument, if you are of such fortunate caliber, to be an instrument of the divine. But you may not make the divine your slave. Certainly you may have powers upon the way up, and you may be able to demonstrate those powers, but those are not a demonstration of the Supreme Self that is realized. Sri Yukteswar says you may have power over all three dimensions of creation and yet not have God. So the Yani puts his mind upon realizing the highest spiritual realization. The highest spiritual realization goes beyond this physical realm. It goes beyond the energetic realm of the astral body and worlds. It goes beyond the causal, the idea realm. Now these realms are extremely subtle and seducing along the way. To gain powers, to have elevated thoughts are beautiful, wonderful things when they are viewed from the right perspective. But when the ego interacts with these, they act as obstacles. So all the great scriptures warn us against going into powers, and powers will be presented to you as you make this upward ascension into the divine. You will feel psychic powers. You will feel power to change yourself, to be able to move yourself through thought, to be able to change your size again through thought, to be able to manifest things through thought. Now these are all natural occurrences to the fully realized being. But one who has gone the whole way does not concern themselves with these. Why? Because there is something infinitely greater that can be had. There's a story of the thief who was walking along one day, and he met a saint. Previously, the saint had picked up this rock. He thought it was quite beautiful, and so he fancied it just to carry it with him. It happened to be a large rock of gold. Now, the saint, with his equal vision, didn't even think about it being gold as being valuable or anything else. He liked the color of it. He liked the light that emanated from it, and so he was carrying it along in his hand. Of course, when the thief saw the saint carrying this, he immediately demanded the article from the saint. The saint, without any self-consciousness whatsoever, handed over this rock of gold to the thief. The thief noticed that the saint had no attachment whatsoever, treated it as if it was a clod of earth. So the thief ran away, thinking himself greatly fortunate. But this act of handing over this rock of gold worked on the mind of the thief. He couldn't get it out of his mind. How easily, with what unattachment, the saint had handed over this tremendously valuable rock to him. And finally, he retraced his steps, and he tracked down the saint. And he came to him, and he said, "Saint," he says, "I have been bothered. You handed over to me this rock that I consider the most valuable thing in the world, as if it meant nothing. I want to know what you know that is so valuable that this rock means absolutely nothing to you, because you have obviously got a greater treasure. And so the saint took him under his wing and began to teach him the great truths and how to attain to the Supreme Consciousness. Ramakrishna once took a rupee coin in one hand and a clod of earth in another, and he threw them both into the Ganges to test himself. Did he discern any difference whatsoever between that rupee coin and the clod of earth? And he took another one, and he threw them in. And he took another, and he threw them in, and he discerned in himself absolutely no attachment to either the rupee or the clod of earth. Both had equal value to him. Through this way, the mind learns to discriminate what is of real value. Now, we as householders and as those who live in the world use money as an exchange and a means of being able to pay our bills, to buy food, to buy clothes, and all the rest of it. And so it does not demand of us to throw away all of our money into the river as if it were nothing. But it does call upon us to use that inner discernment to test ourselves, to see what our attachment is to money, to material possessions, to the things that we have. Do we possess certain items, or do those items possess us? When we feel that we cannot live without something, or we could not part with something, that item then possesses us. When we feel that we could easily part, if demanded, with anything that we have and surrender it to God, to give it in the form of God to anyone who comes, then we have arrived at a place of detachment. And through inner wisdom, we have discerned what is real and true and of lasting value. There is a story of the man who is a great miser. And there is a saying that you can't take it with you. But this miser decided that he would take it with him. And so when he left the body, through great effort of will, he dragged this brick of gold with him all the way to heaven. He's very proud of himself. And he thought, this will be such a great thing to have. When he got to the gates of St. Peter, St. Peter looked at this great big brick of gold, and he said, another paving brick. And he grabbed it and he threw it in a great big pile of bricks that were just casually dropped over to the side. He says, how nice of you to bring that. No, welcome, come on in, you know. The man was absolutely astounded, because it had no value there whatsoever. So when we use this discriminative mind, we decide on what's true, what is real, from what is unreal. In the Upanishads, the prayer says, lead me to the real from the unreal, or lead me from the unreal to the real, from the mortal to immortality, from ignorance to truth. It is a universal, an absolutely beautiful prayer. When we use this mind in order to discern what is real from what is unreal, the mind itself cannot contain reality, but it can begin to discriminate between what leads us to freedom, what leads us to realization, and what detracts us. It is far better at discerning what detracts us, what keeps us from entering into our freedom. Because true freedom means this mind becomes at a standstill. There is within us a great quiet, a great stillness that defies any logical description. Any other reasoning mind cannot really enter into that sphere, but it can be experienced. It cannot be contained, but it can be experienced, and God can be known within us. And so by identifying what is not of God, what distracts us from God. Now, there may be some desires that are entirely harmless. We have a desire to have, perhaps, a home or a car, transportation, having clothes, having food. And as we examine ourselves, we see that none of that binds us. We can have those thoughts, we can have those desires, but we don't feel that they own us, that they possess us, but rather they are just things that move through us and they cause us no harm whatsoever. We can analyze them and see if that they're for good. Do they harm anybody? Are they for our individual good? Are they for our collective good? And if we can say yes to all of those things and we examine ourselves and we see that they are not possessing us, then we can call those good desires. There are those other desires that draw us away from the light. They are so strong in us, or they are of such a character that they obscure the light that is within us, that we know that they are not of God and that they lead us into a greater sense of being in prison rather than being free. By using the mind wisely in this way, we can eliminate that which is not of God. There's the wonderful story of the two images, or rather the two stones, late at night. They were both in the temple, and one of the stones was the stone image of God. The other stone were the stone steps that led up to the image of God. And so late at night, when there is no pilgrims about, the stone steps began to speak to the stone image. And it said, "Hey, you, up there." It said, "You, all the pilgrims come to. They bow to you, they put sandal paste on you, they give you fruit, they give you flowers, they lay money at your feet, they worship you. And me, they step all over me. They don't even give me a second thought. They're just making their way to see you. And yet we are made of the same stuff. Can you explain to me why they are stepping all over me, abusing me, and worshiping you?" And so the stone image said, "Well, the master carver originally started on you. And he started chipping away from you. But you gave him such resistance that eventually he set you aside. Then he picked me up and he started chipping away. And I thought, well, I don't like this very much, but there must be a reason for it. And so I patiently waited as he chipped away. Now there was an image of God that was within this stone all the time. But it was covered over with this dross. Gradually, the master carver chipped away and chipped away, removing everything that was not God. And in the end, what was revealed was the image of God that always resided within the stone. All that was needed was that all the dross be removed. And that is why the pilgrims today come and they worship me. And you, they trample on." And so this is a wonderful story about what happens to each one of our souls, that the master carver will come into our life. He'll begin his work on us. And if we have some understanding that there is something of a wonderful nature going on in our lives, that those chips that we take, those knocks, those blows, are all geared to chip away that which is not of God. And we keep our mind focused upon the divine and we allow whatever is not of God to be released to go into the fire. Now, when we have thoughts that we recognize that are not helpful to us, that are detracting us from the light, we can use a mental image that becomes a powerful friend and ally to us to remove those thoughts. We can hold up within the imagery of our own mind a great big black X, or perhaps a great big red stop sign. And we put that in front of whatever is bothering us, whatever is distracting us from the divine. Now, nature abhors a vacuum, and so does the mind. So we can't just stop with Xing out a thought. But then we need to work even harder. We need to create an image of ourselves or a thought that we can focus the mind upon in replacement of this other thought. And so we think of ourselves, let us say that we have an image of ourselves as being afraid. Some illness looms up in our minds. And that's a serious illness, and suddenly fear just takes a grip on us. So we go to work on that image of being helpless within that illness, having pain, and all the rest of the kinds of fearful images that would come up around an illness. And we put an X in front of each one of those. But we can't leave it just there. We then go to work. And we form an image of ourselves of who are we if we're not that. If we're not that ill person, if we're not that fearful person, if we're not that person who is in the grip of something beyond the power to escape it. And there we put our mind upon the God Self, the light body within us, that being that transcends the body and is more powerful than any illness. And we keep our mind upon that. We find that connection within ourselves, within our heart, where we connect to that divine presence and power that is within us. And we put our mind clearly and squarely upon that. And we don't let go of it, no matter what. Even if that illness were to take us, so to speak, and to destroy this body, and we were to leave this body. When we leave this body, if we leave it with that idea of perfect health, of focus on the light, on the divine, then we carry that pattern with us. And if it is ours to be born again into a new body, we will carry that idea of perfection with us into the new body. And in that way, we are helping to create a better future for ourselves. If by keeping our mind upon the light, we free ourselves completely of physical karma, and the illness takes this body, and we were to leave this body, then we totally enter into the divine light. Because that is all that we have fixed our mind upon. We have never accepted any imperfection as our ultimate truth. It doesn't mean you have to deny that the body is struggling with some difficulty, with some ailment. But you keep your mind always upon the perfect truth that you, in your true self, reside beyond that. And in this way, you keep yourself open to the light. And you keep yourself in perfect thought of health, and through that, you create that for yourself. And there have been many, many people who have gone into spontaneous remissions and had healings of things, of illnesses that were thought to be terminal. And it is all done by what you focus the mind upon. It is by keeping it focused upon the truth, on light, on the eternal verities that reside within your soul. The adherence must be done with strength, with will, and you can ask upon the supreme power to give you that strength, to give you that will, to keep your mind where it should be, without deviation. And if you do that, you will rise above whatever your problem is, whether it is an illness, whether it is a desire that you want to be rid of. And so you axe out what you don't want, and you create an image of yourself of what you do want, and you hang on to it, you reinforce it, you keep that as your primary thought. It doesn't mean that you can't deal with whatever is affecting your body through medicines, through doctors, through other healings. But inwardly, you always keep yourself free and focused upon the Infinite Mother was a great example of this. As she went through so many difficulties, strokes, heart attacks, shingles, and always what she said, I am instructing my body to be the way that it used to be. I want my mind and my body to operate in the way that they once did. And she never let go of that idea. And even though she was paralyzed half of her body with stroke, she returned to normal functioning in practically every aspect of her body. She didn't have full function of her left hand, which she played the piano. She kind of rocked it a little bit. She didn't have all the dexterity there. And to my knowledge, that's the only thing that she didn't have full recovery of from this devastating stroke that she had. So it is possible. And we can come back from terrific things. Mother had gone through two complete paralysis of the body from the neck down and recovered total functioning of her body both times. So she is a tremendous example of holding on to the divine image within your body that transcends your physical body. But by holding on to that image, it instills that perfection within every cell of your body and can return you into full functioning of your health. So let us use the mind in order to attain everything that God intends for us in this lifetime, on the material plane, on the energetic plane, on the mental plane. All abundance is yours. When you think about all abundance being yours, materially, energetically, causally, mentally, sense your aura, that energy field that's around you, and sense it in front of you, to the side of you, behind you. It's just a feeling, it's just a sense that you're checking in with. Above you, below you. And sense what your openness is for prosperity, abundance, the allness of divine spirit coming to you materially, energetically, and mentally. Are you open? Do you have some openness, but some is closed? Are you mostly closed and a little bit open? Do you feel mostly closed? You can sense it. You can feel it. There may be parts of you that are open and other parts that are closed. And if you are closed, then you are inhibiting the flow of divine prosperity, of mental prosperity, of energetic prosperity, of material prosperity. And so work with yourself. Work to open that. Work to open yourself gradually, more and more, for all abundance, everything that you need, to come flowing to you, to be an instrument of divine consciousness so that you will be both a fount of prosperity. and a receiver of it, as well as a giver of it. And that there is no limit to it. Through your intellectual prosperity, thoughts, ideas, creativity, all flowing to you, energetic, flowing to your body in abundance, material prosperity, everything that you need to sustain yourself in the physical world and to create a good life for yourself, positive light. All of that is coming to you. There is nothing that inhibits you. There is nothing that says a spiritual person must live in dire consequences, circumstances, rather. Allow that prosperity to flow to you. That is God's abundance. As Babaji said to Lahimasya, it is little known in the world that having divine consciousness also gives you access to all good things materially. And then the question becomes, do you own it or does it own you? And if it owns you, then you have work to do. But if it is something that you feel that you possess, and like the manager of an estate, you don't own the estate, but you are responsible for its maintenance while you have it, and then as soon as you're done with it, God takes it away from you. He says, all right, my son, enough of this management business. You're free now. You don't have to take care of all these material things again. And then you are free. Here, to be good stewards over what we are given, that things should be kept in neat, clean, good order, and ready to turn over at a moment's notice. And with it, when everything that we have is ready to be turned over, anytime God says, turn this over, let it go. And we have that attitude that we are the good steward. And like the good steward, when the real owner comes and says, ah, give this away, then you give it away without a second thought, without any hesitation, because you know that it was never yours, not in the sense of something to keep, but just simply as a steward. And then you will be free, and you will be open to all prosperity coming to you on every level. So open yourself, work on that, and make yourself a divine instrument of prosperity, not just for yourself, but for everybody. But most of all, open yourself to that spiritual prosperity. Let it come to you in abundance. Let the flow of divine joy and bliss be yours. Let the flow of divine love ever move through your heart to all expression, to all creation. Let creativity flow through your mind. But the great fount of God is the origin of it. And you will know such joy, such happiness, such peace, such perfection in living out your life exactly as God designed it, by discriminating between the real and the unreal. You will know that joy. Let us have our closing prayer.
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being,
Cell of my body,
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Vancouver Island and a marriage ceremony there for Andrew Schmidt and Lori, and then down to Victoria and a talk there, and then back to Maple Ridge and another talk Friday. So almost over 2,500 miles. Kept these sadhus moving. Wonderful time. Consider it the greatest privilege that my guru enabled me to be able to serve everyone in the way that God has designed it. And each one of you who come is God in human form. I feel such great love. Nothing greater in the world than going to God together. It can be a difficult journey at times, so it's nice to be that support, that light, to be able to give to each other. Group forming up in Victoria. So I'll be going up there the first Sunday, going up to Vancouver on the first Friday, and then up to Victoria on the first Sunday of each month. So if you've never been to Victoria or would like to come, I'm sure we'd be able to find a place for you to stay. It's a beautiful city. Pregnancy coming.
Very well.
Good.
It's bigger and bigger.
Wonderful. It's quite miraculous, isn't it? It's like planting a seed in the ground and watching it grow only more. It's a new soul coming. Master said that when conception happens, the spermatozoa and the ovum come together and emits an astrolite, and that there's actual a competition for souls to come into that, because it's rare. We think with 5 billion people that it wouldn't be so rare getting on Earth, but
that it's actually a rare privilege to find the right circumstances to get onto Earth. And so those souls compete to get in, and that the competition, the battle for life, starts even at conception of who gets in. I don't know. Maybe it's the one who wants it the most, who sees it as the greatest opportunity. So, teaches us never to take this life for granted. We have great opportunity if we take advantage of it. Sometimes think of how many lifetimes we have gone through, and at the end, as we're taken out of the body, and we think, oh, I'd hoped so much for myself. I had hoped to make so much more spiritual progress, personal progress. But here we are. We're in the middle of it, and we can remember in the dream, oh yeah, this is what I came to do. I get caught up with everything else too much. Outward life is good and important as well, but that the inner life is what we really value when it's all said and done. But the privilege of bringing in a new soul is a great one and a great responsibility. Perhaps because they chose that soul as the father, that agreement was made.
But they also think and hear from a very early time.
I remember before I came into this life and leaving the family that I was with, and they're such wonderful people. Such great wisdom, such wonderful people. And I knew that there were going to be difficulties along the way. But they said, you will have somebody. We will make sure of it. And I knew I knew later on that was Mother. Would have that help. Master said, some people think that babies are just concerned with their toes. And here he is, he has other languages floating through his brain, and all the experiences of past lifetimes, and all of that is inside of him, but he doesn't have the language or the ability to express it. We think, why don't we remember previous lifetimes? We don't even remember our first six or seven years, maybe a few fragment memories here and there. Before we're 10, we don't have all that much memory. A little bit here and there, we remember. It's not hard then to know that we don't remember even previous lifetimes.
Maybe it's merciful.
It could be very merciful.
Same getting stuck.
But if we need that information, it comes to us spontaneously. I've had many experiences such as that. And it helped me to unravel whatever psychological difficulty or physical difficulty I was wrestling with at the time. But if we just get involved with it as an alternate drama, it takes us nowhere then. It's just more ignorance being loaded on the ignorance we already have.